Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. I also serve the Raynham Mission, which meets the first Sunday of each month in Raynham, and vacancy pastor for St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. I'd like to invite you along to join us for a service at any of these congregations. But if you don't live in those areas, then why not go to www.lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button and find the Lutheran congregation that is nearest to where you live. Go pay them a visit. I'm sure that you will be warmly welcomed. I'd also like to remind you that you can listen to any of our past episodes of The Lutheran Inquisitor by going to our website, lutheranradio.co.uk, click on the podcasts, and go to the archives and find all of our past broadcasts, not only of The Lutheran Inquisitor, but all of the programs aired on Lutheran Radio UK. Today, we continue our interview with Dr. Lorraine Brew. Dr. Brew is Associate Professor of Music at Valparaiso University. She holds the Frederick J. Cruz Endowed Chair for Church Music. Last week, we were speaking with Dr. Brew about church music, and we'd love to continue that conversation today. Dr. Brew, welcome back to the Lutheran Inquisitor.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Could you give us perhaps a quick summary of what we talked about last week, in particular, why you think church music is so important?
Well, I decided to invest my life in that in that proposition, so I do believe it's very important, and I think it gives a way of bringing people together in Christian community like none other.
Now, you gave us a very interesting and concise history of how church music developed over the centuries, and we kind of concluded by talking about where it is now. So, what makes church music different from all other types of music?
I think, and I'll start again with Luther, because I think it's so helpful to understand what he was getting at, is that I differentiate church music from any other music just in its function. So folk music can be used for secular purpose. Folk music can be church music. Jazz, same thing. Classical music, rock and pop, same thing. It's not any style of music that keeps it from being church music. And I think that's really key as we go forward now with so many varieties of music around us and awareness of so much global music that we didn't know 50 years ago. It's hard to decide then what we use. And so sorting and sifting is really important.
So do you think, again, there are many who say church music, it's a waste of time, but do you think church music has a future?
Well, I think those two things might be different. I would never think it's a waste of time. I think the future of the church is in a difficult place. You know, most of the mainline denominations in the U.S. and in Europe are declining in membership, not growing. And the growth in the church is in other continents. So if there is a future in church music, we have to ask, is there a future in the church? And I think that jury is still out. I think here in England, we see a very small percentage of people attending church. It's much higher in the U.S., but it's declining. So I hope there's a future for church music. I certainly believe in training young musicians to serve as musicians in the church. So it's still something I believe in and I hope for them. But it worries me to see the church on the decline.
And it really is much harder to find church musicians these days. Do you think perhaps that has at least played a role in the decline of the church? Is over the years our musicianship has become, I think, probably not as good as it was in the past?
Well, I think it's kind of a chicken and egg conversation. For instance, I recruit students to come and study church music at Valparaiso University. And yet, it's harder now to recruit them because they don't see much assurance that they'll be able to work professionally as church musicians. So then, if they don't, then they're not available. And then the church is going to have to figure out what to do with musicians who haven't received the training. So it's hard to say where that all starts, which side it starts from. I believe if there were positions for church musicians, then there are always people willing to lead.
You mentioned in your work training church musicians that it seems to be, they seem to be fewer and fewer. I mean, how do you see them coming into this, and is there a way, again, perhaps of trying to reverse that trend?
Well, I think that Lutheran colleges and universities have a great responsibility to keep this alive. I think more than any other denomination, we understand how important it is that the life of the church be focused in praise and in communal praise and communal singing. So, yes, I think that's something that we need to keep that banner high for.
And again, how do you think this relates then to the youngsters who are coming into training? How do they view church music, and why is it so important to them? And I suspect it may be the same reason it was so important to you, but...
There's not one typical church music student anymore. And in fact, we've changed at Valparaiso our degree program so that you don't have to be an organ major. That used to be kind of the standard of our program, but now you can come in and get a church music degree as a pianist, or actually as a flutist. And so we've expanded our understanding of what it means to be trained as a church musician. And I think that needs to go on and continue.
And again, I think that is a wonderful thing, because I recall in my first parish, which was suburban Chicago, not only did we have a brilliant organist, he was tremendous, but we had wonderful musicians. We had a fellow that played the trumpet, and one who played the trombone, and a flutist. And they worked together beautifully, and it enhanced the wonder and the magic of the worship service. So can you talk about how perhaps use of other instruments can play a vital role within the worship service?
Well, for one thing, it gives people opportunity for leadership. So I think it helps if you have a musician who can help them know how to make their contribution. So central to the idea is someone who knows what's good for the church to have and what's good for any particular person. But then knowing how to explore lots of different varieties of music so that people can feel comfortable in the place that they are. I started to talk a little bit about the church music students who come to us today, and they're not of one stripe anymore. Some of them, in fact, most of the ones who come as organ majors don't really like contemporary music and don't really like rock music. And so they need to be expanded as well, just like people who only want to have rock music in church need to have their views expanded.
And again, I think even with congregational members, I've noticed that most of them anymore can't even read music.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we help facilitate that? And also, we have smaller congregations. How can perhaps the formation of a choir, even if it's only four or five people, how can that help the worship life of a congregation?
Yeah, it's tough. It's definitely tough. And if the church takes on the role of teaching people how to read music, then that's an even a more increased role. However, there's great precedent for that. The singing schools that grew up in the United States were formed in order to teach people how to read music in a very simple way, in that shape note singing that Americans, particularly in the Appalachian area, developed. And the church played a part in helping people be trained, learning how to read music. We don't really do that much today, although the children's choir program that I directed when I was in the parish in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, we actually started our multi-level choir right as the grade schools were dropping music from their school curriculum. And so we did take on the challenge of teaching them music reading skills, because they weren't going to be getting it in the schools. And that actually It was actually a great serendipity because it contributed to the success of our program, because people came not only to have their kids sing in the children's choir, but to learn how to read music.
And we, I think, have the obligation to help our congregation members learn new music, learn new hymns. I love what our organist says about when we try and introduce a new hymn. He says, they're just strangers who haven't met yet, friends who haven't met yet. Mm-hmm. And so how can we help introduce our members to some of the new hymnody that's being written?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that I work on with my students quite a bit. I think we have to try to get at people from several different angles. I encourage students, for instance, to write things for the newsletter talking about the importance of this or that as before the congregation confronts it. So they start to see that we're not just throwing things at them, but there are reasons and hopefully thought out ones for bringing anything new into the congregation. And then I think a rehearsed group of singers is very helpful in the beginning. People who are willing to spend some time outside of worship to present the music inside of worship. And then I have nothing against some congregational rehearsal. I don't think that that's really detrimental to the worship, but that is the one place when everyone is together. And so I think there's nothing wrong with rehearsing a new hymn ahead of the service before you sing it, and then at least it's a little familiar when it comes in worship. And then I think understanding how much and how often repetition should happen. Because the first time you sing something, it's not going to feel familiar. But if you sang the same thing 5 times in a row, that might feel overdone. So figuring out what kind of pace the congregation can learn in it and how much and when, I think is a great, I was going to say trick, but I'll say skill.
Now, we were just talking about new hymns. As people talk about hymns, they often think, oh, they're ancient. They're, 1,500 years old or 500 years old. But there are a lot of hymns still being written today, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, there was certainly we call it the hymnal explosion that happened in the 20th century where English-speaking languages, or English-speaking people in particular, shared lots of hymn texts ecumenically across English-speaking countries. And so there's been lots and lots of new hymn writing. Some of it, I think, a little bit of it will stay and most of it will go away, just like happens in every generation.
Now, as I understand it, part of your work here while you're in Cambridge is doing some reviews of modern church music or different things that are happening. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what really is going on in the scene of church music at the moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, here it's a very professional scene with highly trained organ scholars who work at the college chapels, who then are trained under in some cases, celebrity musicians here in Cambridge, to uphold this very high liturgical tradition of men and boys choirs. And so that's a wonderful scene, which I love to observe. And I've had the opportunity then to have interviews with several of these somewhat celebrities and talk to them about their ideas about church music today. And it started actually coincidentally just about a year ago when we visited York Minster for an evensong. And one of their emeritus organists, Francis Jackson, whom I had heard of in the U.S., I'd played a couple of his compositions, was being honored on the centenary of his birth. I actually didn't even know he was alive. I wasn't that closely connected to what his life was. So anyway, we happened in on this centenary of his birth, and wouldn't you know it, he was there. So I saw that there was some attention around him, and I thought, that's him. And sure enough, he was there. He turned 100, and after the service, he was honored by the dean of the Minster, and he spoke. He actually still plays the organ on Sundays at a little church near his house. And it was just so inspiring to me. I started clicking pictures during the reception once I realized what I had happened in on. So then I wrote to the senior editor of an American organ magazine called The Diapason, and I said, guess what I just happened in on? And so I wrote it up as an article and got permission from York Minster to get some photos of the events and had a first article published. So then on that success, very random success, I got up my nerve and asked for an interview with Stephen Cleobury, who is the director of music at King's College here in Cambridge. And much to my surprise, he had an opening in his schedule like 4 days later, and I went in and interviewed him. And the Diapason published that article as well last February. So then I thought, well, if Stephen Cleobury will talk to me, maybe John Rutter would talk to me. So I contacted John Rutter, who is most beloved as an American, I mean, in America as a British choral writer. And sure enough, he was willing to talk to me as well. So that article is going to be published in the December issue of the Diapason because he's especially known for his Christmas works. Next week, I'll be interviewing Colin Walsh, who's the organist emeritus at the Lincoln Cathedral. And so that will go on.
So what kind of questions are you asking them? Are you talking to them about the future of church music?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it mystifies me being here, how this can go on, this fabulous tradition that few people attend, and how this can be. And, you know, once you peek behind the curtain, you see that it takes a lot to hold up, for instance, a program like King's College. And they worry about whether it will be sustained. And Ely Cathedral, for instance, which also has a very fine program, struggled a few years ago to decide that they were either going to have to close the building or charge admission to it. And they decided to charge admission to keep the programs going, to keep the building going. So it's difficult here, but it's different issues. Here, you've got this great tradition that most the people around here feel very committed to. But then you've got the parish, you know, struggling along in its own way without much support, much like many U.S. churches.
As well as your interviews, you're also doing a lot of teaching as the director of the overseas Cambridge program for Valparaiso. Can you tell us about your connection with that, your connection with Westfield House, and the work that you're doing here in Cambridge?
Love to. I'm here for a 2-year stint, and I'm about a year and a half through. And each semester we bring students over from Valparaiso to spend a semester immersed in this place and in this culture. As part of that, I teach a course on British life and culture, which I just try to stay one day ahead of the students as best I can, since I'm not an expert in British life and culture. But it's fun to learn together. And then I teach another course, Church Music and Liturgical Theology, that is an elective for our students as well as for the students at Westfield House. We then share courses so that students can take Valparaiso University courses through Westfield, and we take courses both at Westfield House and at Anglia Ruskin University. And then through Westfield House, our students are also able then to attend University of Cambridge classes, which is just a wonderful asset for us.
And a wonderful thing. I was visiting Cambridge not long ago, and your class led the chapel service that evening, and it was a wonderful experience. Again, can you tell us how you work with them and what you try to teach them in the class?
Yeah, that was an assignment, a group assignment for them to plan and lead an evening prayer service. And so in preparation for that, we talked about, you know, the Benedictine offices, the daily offices, and where they came from and how they've gotten now kind of smashed down into Matins, Vespers, and Compline for the Lutherans, Matins and Vespers for the Church of England. And we looked at the elements of gathering and psalm and word and prayer that come up in every daily office. And then I let them loose with the texts, with the lectionary texts. So they couldn't choose those. They were given the lectionary texts, which ended up, I don't know if you remember, but they ended up being very rough texts. And I told them to read the lessons deeply, and then to frame a service, 20 minutes, that we could pray together. And I was very proud of them. I thought they did a very nice job.
It was. It was a wonderful service.
Thanks.
And again, I think a real testament to the fact of how even the liturgy, you know, the liturgy touched them and how they used it to really bring us together as a community.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe that it happens. I think we can set it up, but it happens kind of, not in spite of us, but if with good planning with our help, but with bad planning sometimes in spite of us.
And again, I'm going to give Lutheran Radio a plug because we have matins and morning prayer, vespers, evening prayer, and compline on every day.
Oh,
so again, we want to offer offer worship is at the heart of what we do, and we want folks to be able to take advantage of that throughout the week.
It's a gift of the church, absolutely.
And can you also then tell us about when you're heading back to the States, back to Valpo in 6 months or so,
mm-hmm.
what it is that you do there and a little bit about Valparaiso University?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure what I'm going to do when I get back there. I took this 2 years to kind of think about lots of things. Certainly in the next 3 to 5 years, I'll be retiring. But I would like to go back and do some theology teaching because my PhD work was actually in systematic theology, not in music. And but then the organ job opened up at Valparaiso and I auditioned for it and went then in that music direction. So I never really got to teach full-time theology. So that's pretty complicated for a university to figure out how to put a person in a couple of departments. So we'll see. My regular position there is organist and director of chapel music. And then I teach organ, direct the church music studies, and teach the curriculum, and then direct our chapel choir, which is called the Cantorai.
And can you tell us a bit about Valpo then as well, the university?
Valpo is an independent, it's kind of it's different from any other. It's a Lutheran, but independent university. It was founded by lay Missouri Synod members who wanted to have a university that wasn't just preparation for clergy and teachers. So it was intentionally formed to be different from the Concordias. It didn't bear the name. That's why it doesn't bear the name of Concordia. And then it has also then given Valparaiso now to become independent in terms of being inclusive of, well, hopefully everyone, but it's certainly pan-Lutheran. We have about an equal number of Missouri Synod and ELCA faculty and about an equal number of LCMS and ELCA students, as well as Wisconsin Synod students. And so it's one place in the U.S. where these students come together and worship and pray and study the Bible and praise all together. And so it's a unique place in that regard.
And you've also then had this long-standing study center in Cambridge.
We have just finished celebrating 50 years here in Cambridge. This was founded in 1968 by a combination of folks, including Norman Nagel, who were integral to the beginning of the ELCE here and also the beginning of founding this seminary and then cooperating with Valparaiso.
Again, we'd like you to take our warmest greetings back to many of our friends at Valparaiso. And we thank you so much for your wonderful insights into church music. We pray God's richest blessings upon your work. And again, we thank you for your time, and we deeply appreciate all of your insights. Dr. Lorraine Brew, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.